Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really going to unpack the shifting landscape of global security. We've got sources covering, well, everything from military moves in Eurasia to some pretty deep policy changes happening within key European countries.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And our goal today is really to give you a shortcut, a way to understand these, you know, surprising new policies that are cropping up to deal with a world that's changing really fast.
Okay, so where do we start? There was a specific event mentioned.
We really have to start there. It was October 28th, just last year, South Korean intelligence officials, they actually went to Brussels. They briefed NATO, but also Indo-Pacific partners like Japan and Australia.
And the briefing was about something pretty shocking, right?
Absolutely. It was about North Korea sending thousands of its troops into Russia's Kursk region.
Wow. Not just weapons, but actual personnel on the ground in Russia for the war in Ukraine.
Exactly. It wasn't just another arms deal. This was, you know, boots on the ground, foreign soldiers helping Moscow's war effort. And that single event, according to our sources, it really drove home this new idea that the old lines, the geographic separation between Asia and Europe, they're basically meaningless now.
So adversaries coordinating in ways we haven't really seen before, creating one big theater.
That's the core concept. A single unified theater of competition right across Eurasia.
Okay, let's dig into that blurring of lines.
Yeah.
Because the sources suggest this coordination, it runs deep. China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, they're all involved.
It's really a full spectrum thing. They're sharing sophisticated weapons, yes, but also know-how. Think about Putin's bombardment campaigns in Ukraine. Our sources are clear. They heavily rely on weapons, tech, even personnel from China, Iran, and North Korea.
But it's not a one-way street, is it? That's the worrying part.
Yep.
No, not at all. And this is where it gets strategically concerning. Moscow is essentially paying back Beijing and Pyongyang. They're sending technologies, thinks stealth, advanced submarines, missiles, even satellite tech things Russia was very reluctant to share before.
And the intelligence community sees this as directly increasing the risk of conflict, potentially in the Pacific.
Significantly increases the risk. It's accelerating capabilities in places like North Korea at a rate that's, frankly, alarming.
And it's not just about the hardware. There are these gray zone operations, too.
Right. Coordinated actions below the threshold of outright war. We've seen joint Chinese and Russian air patrols flying very close to Japan and South Korea's coasts. That's a direct physical provocation.
And online.
Online, it's synchronized, converged disinformation campaigns. You'll see state media from both Russia and China pushing the same narratives, often, you know, blaming NATO for the war in Ukraine, trying to deflect responsibility. It really is a unified front across military, tech, and information domains.
This whole picture, this coordinated Eurasian bloc, it seems to fly directly in the face of, well, decades of fundamental U.S. foreign policy thinking.
It absolutely does. You have to go back to thinkers like Nicholas Spykman back in the 1940s. The core idea, the conviction in U.S. policy circles for generations has been that American global power depends on preventing any single powerful hostile bloc from dominating Eurasia.
Right. The famous Spykman line, who controls the Kremlin, rules Eurasia. The idea being control the coastal edges, the allies around the edge, and you prevent anyone from consolidating power across the whole landmass.
Exactly. Keep potential rivals contained, prevent these continent-spanning alliances. That's been the playbook.
So just when this unified threat, this thing the U.S. always wanted to prevent, seems to be actually forming, what's the current U.S. response, according to the sources?
Well, this is where it gets interesting. The sources suggest the current U.S. approach is almost a throwback. It's encouraging allies to, quote, stick to their neighborhoods, focus locally.
Which seems completely out of sync with this trans-regional threat you just described.
Yeah.
Like Washington's missing the big picture.
It highlights a real doctrinal disconnect.
Yeah.
And there's a specific, quite startling example given. Elbridge Colby, when he was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, reportedly told British officials not to send an aircraft carrier deployment to the Indo-Pacific as planned.
He told the British not to deploy to the Pacific. What was the reasoning?
The gist, as reported, was basically, we don't want you there. The message was, focus on Russia, focus on Europe, leave the Pacific to us, or perhaps just don't get involved globally in that way. It must have been a very awkward conversation for the U.S.-UK special relationship.
And you see hints of this elsewhere, too. Less focus on the Indo-Pacific and official communications.
Yeah, symbolically, Indo-Pacific leaders weren't at the NATO summit in June 2025. That was a first in years. Hmm. And if you look at official readouts of meetings with European allies, mentions of Indo-Pacific security have reportedly just stopped.
Okay, but here's a twist. Washington might be pulling back or trying to compartmentalize, but are the allies actually listening?
And that's the crucial countertrend. The sources emphasize that allies are actually coalescing despite this resistance from Washington. They seem to share an understanding. Japan's former foreign minister Hayashi put it starkly, security in Europe and the Pacific are not separable.
So they're acting on that understanding.
We see concrete examples. Germany and the Netherlands sent frigates to the Indo-Pacific back in 2021. Japan, think about this, has given more bilateral aid to Ukraine than Finland, France, or Poland, major European players.
So Japan is acting like a European security provider, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And these partnerships are becoming more formal.
Yes, outside the traditional NATO structures. France and the Philippines are exploring a deal for joint training, rotational deployments, similar to a deal Japan and the UK already have from 2023. Australia even joined a European military logistics group, the Movement Coordination Center Europe.
It sounds like they're building their own cross-regional networks, almost bypassing Washington's preferences.
And economically, this trend is maybe even more significant. The EU is pushing ahead with trade deals with India, with Indonesia, and European leaders are openly talking about maybe eventually joining the CPTPP.
The Trans-Pacific Trade Pact that the U.S. originally designed and then pulled out of.
That's the one. So you could end up with a situation where the U.S. finds itself outside these major emerging trade blocs in Asia, partly because of its own insistence on this neighborhood-focused policy. It's actively risking its own long-term influence.
Okay, so if allies are building these new links, and the U.S. role is maybe shifting, that brings us to Ukraine. What kind of security guarantees can actually be offered to Kyiv after the war, especially if direct intervention is off the table?
This is a huge debate, and it starts, interestingly, with a critical perspective highlighted in one of our sources. The argument is that the common refrain, you know, that Russia will not stop at Ukraine, might be more of a political narrative than a reflection of pure military reality.
A political narrative? To what end? Why exaggerate the threat if that's what's happening?
Well, according to this view, the rhetoric serves clear purposes. First, it rallies public support for continued expensive aid to Ukraine. Second, it justifies that aid politically. And third, maybe most importantly, it fuels these massive proposed increases in military spending, like the new NATO target being floated, 5% of GDP on defense by 2035.
5%? That's enormous. But what's the counterargument based on military balance?
The counterargument points to the numbers. NATO and its partners collectively outspend Russia roughly 10 to 1. About $1.3 trillion a year versus whatever Russia is managing. NATO has overwhelming advantages in air power, naval power, technology.
And Russia's conventional forces.
They are severely strained. We're talking hundreds of thousands of casualties, huge equipment losses. So the argument goes the idea that this depleted Russian army poses a conventional threat to invade NATO territory right now. It's just not credible from a purely military standpoint.
So if that's the case, then the talk of 5% defense spending starts to look less like strategic necessity and more like threat inflation, maybe driven by the defense industry.
That's exactly the tension, the critical question raised. Is the perceived threat being inflated to justify budgets? It's a really important debate to have. But regardless of that debate about the future threat, the war now is real, and the need for post-war guarantees for Ukraine is also real.
And that's the credibility problem. How do you make guarantees believable when allies, especially the U.S. and NATO, have made it crystal clear they won't send their own troops to fight Russia directly in Ukraine? An Article 5-style promise seems hollow.
Precisely. Moscow knows that. They know direct intervention is the red line the West hasn't crossed. So any guarantee that relies on that same unmet promise isn't really a deterrent. It's a bluff that's already been called.
So what's the alternative? This is where the snapback solution comes in.
Exactly. The core idea isn't promising something new and unbelievable like direct intervention. It's about committing legally and automatically to an intensified version of what allies are already doing if Russia breaks a future ceasefire.
Intensified current behavior. Okay, what makes that genuinely different? How does it work?
The key is the automaticity and the speed. It's designed to make the consequences for Russia immediate and severe, removing any ambiguity or chance for political dithering. There are three main pillars to this snapback mechanism.
Let's break them down. Pillar one, sanctions.
Right. If Russia resumes aggression, boom, full sanctions immediately snap back into place. We're talking kicking Russian banks out of SWIFT again, full export controls on anything dual use, strict oil price caps enforced properly.
That sounds like what was done before, though.
Yeah.
What's the intensification?
The really crucial addition, the game changer, is the commitment to impose secondary sanctions.
Sanctions on other countries.
Yes, on third countries, maybe China, maybe others that are helping Russia evade sanctions or sustain its war economy. Allies have mostly avoided this until now because, well, it hurts their own trade relationships too. Making secondary sanctions automatic and part of the snapback package is a major escalation of economic pressure. It globalizes the cost of Russia's aggression.
Okay, that's significant. Pillar two, military aid.
Again, automatic intensification. If Russia attacks again, the flow of offensive military aid to Ukraine surges immediately. Think more long-range missiles, ATACMS, Storm Shadows, Scalps plus combat aircraft, more tanks, more armor.
And the really big change here involves how those weapons can be used.
Yes. This is probably the most critical and controversial part of the proposal. Removing the range restrictions. Authorizing Ukraine, automatically upon a ceasefire violation, to use these donated long-range systems against military targets inside Russia that are directly supporting the invasion.
That crosses a major red line that exists today. How do the proponents argue this doesn't lead to uncontrollable escalation with Russia?
The argument hinges on the trigger. Because this only happens if Russia breaks a ceasefire first, the action is framed as purely defensive. A pre-agreed consequence, not an unprovoked Western escalation. It's designed as deterrence, making the cost of restarting the war prohibitively high for Moscow because they know this capability will be unleashed.
A preset punishment, essentially. Okay, and the third pillar, financial stability for Ukraine.
Right. You need to ensure Ukraine can actually withstand a renewed assault financially. The proposal is for the G7 to establish a standing Ukraine stabilization fund. If Russia attacks, this fund automatically disperses large amounts of budgetary support to the Ukrainian government and provides financing for Ukraine's own military production.
So Russia can't just bet on bankrupting Ukraine or waiting for Western political will to fade.
Exactly. It removes that wait them out strategy.
Now, for any of this to be credible, these aren't just promises, right? Yeah. They need teeth.
Absolutely critical. These commitments, sanctions, military aid, funding, they have to be codified into law beforehand. Think U.S. legislation or within the EU using mechanisms like qualified majority voting clauses for foreign policy decisions.
Qualified majority voting.
Yeah.
That avoids one country being able to veto action.
Precisely. It speeds things up immensely, bypasses potential blockers.
Right.
And the trigger mechanism itself needs to be flipped.
Flipped. How so?
Instead of requiring guarantors to agree Russia violated the ceasefire, the proposal flips the burden of proof. If Kyiv claims a violation, the snapback measures automatically take effect unless a majority of the guarantor nations actively votes to say Ukraine is wrong, maybe within a tight time frame like 48 hours.
So the default is action, not inaction.
Yes. That structural change, that legal codification and automatic trigger, is what could potentially give this mechanism the credibility that vague diplomatic promises lack. It moves it from we promise to react to this will happen if you cross the line.
Okay, so we have this shifting global picture, new ideas for deterrence. Let's turn to how a key player, Germany, is actually changing internally to deal with all this, and significantly hedging against the possibility of the U.S. pulling back from Europe.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating case study. We're looking at the chancellorship of Friedrich Merz, who came into office in May 2025. The context was stark. A feeling in Germany that they faced the biggest security threat since the Cold War, combined with real anxiety about the reliability of the U.S. commitment to NATO.
And Merz came in promising big changes. The most dramatic was on finance, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Tackling the debt brake.
Absolutely historic. His party, the CDU, had championed Germany's constitutional debt brake, the Schuldenbremse, for years. It's this deeply ingrained rule-mandating balanced budgets. Merz reversed course.
Why was that so hard politically, but so necessary strategically?
Politically, it was huge. The debt brake is almost sacred in German fiscal conservatism. Attacking it opened him up to criticism of being fiscally reckless, but strategically, it was seen as the only way to generate the massive funds needed quickly.
So what did the reversal enable?
It enabled the creation of a huge $500 billion special fund spread over 10 years, mainly for infrastructure, but with a key change. Security and defense spending were explicitly exempted from the balanced budget rule going forward.
Ah, so that's how they plan to hit the new defense spending targets, that 3.5% of GDP goal by 2029.
Exactly. It removed the main obstacle, That 3.5% target isn't just a number. It fundamentally changes Germany's weight within NATO and addresses decades of U.S. complaints about burden sharing. It signals a profound shift in Germany's role.
And beyond just spending more money, Merz also pushed for policy shifts regarding Ukraine itself.
Yes, several key ones. He overturned Germany's longstanding opposition to using frozen Russian sovereign assets, the central bank funds, to actually pay for Ukraine's war effort. That was a radical step, especially thinking ahead to a scenario with potentially less U.S. financial backing for Kyiv.
A very pragmatic, maybe even ruthless calculation there. What about military support models?
Berlin shifted towards what's described as a Danish model. Basically, instead of just sending finished weapons, Germany started signing agreements to fund the production of things like long-range strike drones inside Ukraine using German components, building up Ukraine's own defense industrial base.
That's a longer-term investment.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still providing high-end systems directly.
Oh, yes. Germany is noted as the largest European provider of the U.S. Patriot air defense systems to Ukraine. Filling that critical air defense gap is a major priority.
What about the Taurus missiles? The long-range ones Germany makes? Merz used to demand they be sent, didn't he?
He did, very publicly, before becoming chancellor. Now, the sources say it's a sensitive topic he tends to avoid discussing publicly. However, it suggested that Taurus could easily reappear on the table as a key component of a future snapback security guarantee package for Ukraine, something held in reserve.
Interesting. So funding, weapons, but also institutional changes within the German government, the National Security Council.
This is potentially a very big deal. Germany created a proper National Security Council, an NSC. The old body, the Federal Security Council, was apparently quite limited, mostly just reviewing arms export licenses. It wasn't equipped for real strategic planning.
So the new NSC is meant to be more like the US or UK model,
mm-hmm.
Integrated, strategic.
That's the intention. To develop a genuinely integrated security policy based on shared intelligence assessments, looking beyond just the immediate crisis of the day towards a long-term whole-of-government strategy.
And politically, Merz made a move to centralize control over this.
He did. He brought the Foreign Office back under the control of his party, the CDU. Apparently, that hadn't happened since 1966. It was a clear signal that foreign and security policy were now top priorities directly driven by the chancellery.
But does the structure guarantee success? Will the NSC actually be used effectively?
And that's the big question mark. The sources point out that the NSC's actual influence depends entirely on whether Chancellor Merz chooses to use it consistently for real decision making. Given his reported preference for more informal personal diplomacy, there's a risk it could remain somewhat symbolic. Its potential is huge, but its usage is key.
Okay, so let's try and tie these threads together as we wrap up. We've seen the emergence of this unified Eurasian challenge, forcing allies to link up across regions in new ways.
Right. Then we looked at the need for a credible deterrence for Ukraine, moving beyond empty promises to mechanisms like the snapback system automatic swift consequences.
And finally, the deep, costly, and quite revolutionary internal changes that key allies like Germany are undertaking to meet these threats. And importantly, to prepare for a potentially less reliable U.S.
And weaving through all of this is that central choice, really, for Washington. Does the U.S. engage with and try to shape these new allied networks that are forming anyway across the Atlantic and Pacific? Or does it stick to this stay-in-your-neighborhood approach and risk finding itself sidelined in a global order that's reorganizing without it?
It feels like the U.S. is actively risking its central position by telling allies, essentially, to stay home while the world connects around them.
It's a major strategic gamble if that's the path chosen.
So as a final thought for you, our listener, to consider, there's this inherent tension we've touched on. On one side, you have the urgent calls for massive, rapid military buildup. One source mentioned doubling long-range strike weapon production within 5 years. Real industrial mobilization.
But on the other side, you have that critical analysis warning about threat inflation, the idea that portraying Russia as this unstoppable juggernaut, when the military balance suggests otherwise, might just be channeling vast sums into potentially unnecessary weapons programs.
So how do nations strike that balance? How do you prepare genuinely for real threats? And the threats are real, without falling into the trap of a self-perpetuating security industrial complex that constantly needs bigger threats to justify its existence.
That's the tightrope walk, isn't it? Balancing prudent preparation against strategic sobriety. Getting that balance right between fear and fact. Well, that's probably the defining challenge for leaders in Washington, Berlin, Tokyo, and beyond for the next decade.